Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. Today's program is sponsored by the UC Davis Center for Healthy Aging and the UC Academic Geriatric Resource Program. I'm Judy Sitko, Executive Director of the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California. The coalition was formed in 1999 to improve the way that we care for Californians in the final chapter of life. We have nearly 100 members working collaboratively together, including healthcare providers, consumers, and regulatory agencies. Our topic today is PULSED, Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. PULSED is a standardized order, medical order, that expresses the individual's wishes for life-sustaining treatment, and it travels with the patient across healthcare settings. With me today is Dr. Jim Middleberger to tell us more about PULSED. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here, Judy.
Dr. Middleberger has a wealth of experience that's helpful to our topic today. Dr. Middleberger is a board-certified geriatrician and palliative care doctor. He was formerly the chief of the Division of Geriatrics and Palliative Care at Alameda Medical Center. He's been teaching and working on these issues for over 20 years. He did a fellowship in clinical ethics with research focus on communication issues at the end of life. He's currently the chief medical officer for Evercare and United Healthcare Medicare Solutions for the West Region. He's also president-elect of the California Association of Long-Term Care Medicine. So, Dr. Middleberger, why is it that you got interested in PULSED?
Well, you know, we have a serious safety and healthcare problem at the end of life. We are unable in our healthcare system to give people the treatments they want and make sure that they don't get treatments that they don't want. And I had some cases that just became more disturbing to me. It started to have me understand how poorly we were taking care of people at the end of life. I had one gentleman who, after a decade of struggling with a progressive neurologic disease, went into a nursing home and had decided at that time did not want to be on a ventilator again. But I was no longer his physician. He lived in the south part of the county. And we do not have a good, effective system of transferring orders from one setting to another setting. Lo and behold, he had trouble breathing. The system goes through its somewhat knee-jerk response, and he's in an ICU on a ventilator. Well, we called, we talked through that. He became much weaker, much, much more debilitated, but survived. Actually, it was at a point that he really almost wished he hadn't survived, did not want to go through any more of his progressive decline, went back out to a different nursing home, and the same thing happened again. I think it's that kind of experience that's just galvanized me to say that we need to get a system where people get the treatments that they do want and don't get the treatments they don't want, so they don't have to suffer the consequences of treatments that they don't want, but they get all the benefits of the treatments they do want. So I started looking around for a better system than what we had in California.
Great. Well, now that we've had PULSED for a little bit of time here in California, can you tell me of some what kind of difference it has made?
The PULSED form, when it becomes part of the culture of a healthcare system, goes with the patient from the hospital to nursing home. And I have a wonderful case of a woman who did want vigorous treatment, but did not want heroic treatment that wouldn't likely work. So she did want to be put on a ventilator, because if she couldn't breathe, a ventilator often works, and you actually can be revived. Patients in nursing homes are revived all the time being put on a ventilator. But she did not want to have chest compressions done if her heart had completely stopped, because the chances of surviving after your heart has completely stopped is extremely low. I've never seen it in my career in long-term care. So she was able, with the new PULSED form, to have those specific wishes codified in the form, and when her heart stopped, she did not receive the treatment she did not want to have.
So she was able to die very peacefully?
Peacefully, and did not have to go through treatments that in her case would have been extremely unlikely to have worked.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, can you tell me, who is the PULSED form designed for?
The PULSED form is really designed for people who are in a situation where right now they might not want to receive some kinds of invasive treatment that might be life-sustaining. So somebody that has a progressive illness that we wouldn't be surprised if they would die within a year, or somebody who, for whatever reason, would not want to be go through the difficulties of being on a ventilator and possibly not surviving a difficult hospital stay.
And what about someone who does want to receive treatment? Would the pulse still help them?
Absolutely, and that's one of the things I think is most important to understand about the pulse. The pulse form is not just a do not resuscitate form or don't do things form. It actually allows somebody to say, I do want this treatment. And that's very important because some people are willing to go through very difficult procedures and long odds and are willing to risk the possibility of coming back weaker or more debilitated in order to survive. And we need to make sure that their wishes are also respected.
So how is pulse different from an advanced directive or what's called a living will?
Well, an advanced directive is a form codified by law, and a living will is a less, more free-flowing form about your wishes, what you would want in the future. Both of those forms are theoretical, and they're important. An advanced directive, you can specify who you want to decide for you at some time in the future if you lose the ability to decide for yourself. That kind of information is very important, but it's different from a pulsed. A pulsed is a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment, pulsed. It has actionable medical orders that are absolutely that you can absolutely follow here and now. So it is the best document you can have if you know and you're sitting with your physician, know what you want here and now. And when somebody comes to your house and you have an advanced directive and a paramedic is trying to decide what to do or a doctor is trying to decide what to do, they have to interpret an advanced directive. And so they are not going to be able to do that in the kind of emergency situation. A pulsed form is an order form, so it becomes immediately an effective way for you to make sure that you get the treatment you want and don't get treatment you don't want.
Now, with an advanced directive, can you name someone to speak for you, and does POLST allow you to do that, or is it the advanced directive?
Well, an advanced directive, you name someone to speak for you, and that's we are very strongly in favor of advanced directives. You can sit down with your family or with your attorney. You don't need an attorney, but you can sit down or by yourself with a witness and name who you would want to decide for you in the situation that you become incapacitated. That's very important, especially in the future if you do become incapacitated. So you can name somebody. But you haven't talked to your doctor necessarily. So we find that actually the majority of advanced directives, the person has never really gone over this with their doctor. So there are things in the advanced directive that might not make sense. The POLST is a living order form. You have to talk to a doctor. You have to have a doctor's signature, a patient's signature. It's a living document for here and now. So advanced directives, future, POLST, current situation.
Great. Sounds like they're complementary.
They are very complementary.
Now, you did mention a DNR, or do not resuscitate order. So can you tell me a little bit more about how POLST is different from that?
Right. DNR is the most disturbing thing about DNR, do not resuscitate, is it is an order to not receive resuscitation. And what I've showed in my research and has been shown is resuscitation means different things to different people. It's like heroics. So is resuscitation chest compressions, or is resuscitation being put on a ventilator? Or is resuscitation receiving certain chemicals in the veins? It becomes confusing. So the do not resuscitate order becomes very imprecise, and that creates a lot of problems in a situation where you have to make decisions under pressure. So the POLST form is much more precise. It breaks down the categories of orders in much more organized ways so that your wishes can be understood in a stressful situation where an emergency decision needs to be made.
Yeah, and we have a copy of a POLST form right here, and I know that in one box it addresses resuscitation, but there's other sections in here that address other medical treatments. So can you tell me a little bit more about the form?
Sure, I think we'll do a little bit more later. The form has been developed, first of all, in consultation after developing from other states, in consultation with dozens of physicians, medical groups, hospital groups. We've developed this form very carefully and thoughtfully. The first form, Section A, just has to do with whether you would want to have chest compressions or not. If your heart had already stopped, you were not breathing, you really were essentially dead at that point. So that's a very specific decision you make. B, set up for the medical interventions beyond pushing on the chest. And it's broken up into three categories. One is full treatment. So if your heart is still beating and you're still breathing, give full treatment, including putting somebody on a ventilator. Two is intermediate. You want effective treatments, you want to go to the hospital, you want things that will work, but you don't really want to be put on a ventilator. You don't want things that would cause you pain or discomfort at the end of life. You would rather, if you got that sick, be let to that to die. And three is comfort. That is your top goal in your life is comfort. You really don't want treatments just to prolong life. You want things that will keep you comfortable. And I would mention that all treatments and all scenarios always require that we take care of comfort. It is always necessary under California law and ethically that we respect people's dignity and comfort in all situations. Finally, Section C has to do with artificial nutrition. You can specify that you do want to receive tube feeding if you can't eat or drink on your own. You could specify that you'd be willing to consider a defined trial, or you can say you really do not want to be fed by tube feeding. Finally, I think it's important to mention, in addition to those, that there's a Section D. And under Section D in California in our PULSE form, we require both the signature of the physician and the patient or their healthcare representative. And this means that this form can't be filled out without you having thought about this and having gone through it and said that, yes, this does reflect your wishes. And also that a physician has to sign documenting that they also have absolutely reviewed this and that it does reflect your wishes.
So it's kind of a joint document between the patient and the physician.
It is a joint document.
Great. So can the PULSE form ever be changed?
Absolutely. The PULSE form is a serious document. It should not be filled out except carefully, but it can be changed at any time by a competent patient. It also can be changed by the physician with the patient's representative if the situation should change or other information comes to light such that the best understanding of the patient's wishes would be different.
Or maybe if their condition progresses and
right.
they might be making different choices at that point.
The situation could change, and somebody speaking for the patient would say the patient wanted these things in that situation, but I believe that in this situation they would want something different, and that's something the physician and the patient's representative could and should do.
Great. So PULSE has been around for a little while. Can you tell me about some of its history, and how do we know that it's effective in making a difference?
Well, as the PULSE was being entered into California, we looked around nationally, and the PULSE actually has been used in many states, something like somewhere between 15, 18 states in the United States. It's been around more than 15 years. It was developed in Oregon by ethicists and clinicians and has really had a remarkable track record. We've gotten to see how it works in the state of Oregon over time as it's become part of the healthcare system. And research there shows it's remarkably effective in making sure that patients get what they want to get and don't get what they don't want to get in terms of treatments, life-sustaining treatments that may be near the end of life.
And how is it being rolled out here in California? What's happening?
Well, we have been very fortunate in California in that we've received support from the California Healthcare Foundation. So California Healthcare Foundation set this up with 8 local grants to look at how the form might be implemented in California. That began, I believe, sometime in 2007. With that process, we were able to see that it did work in California and gain from the experiences of those community groups in California. And then we had the support of a California senator, Lois Wolk, who passed a bill which empowers the PULSE under California law and provided great support to move this forward as the document for physician orders for life-sustaining treatments at the end of life. And since then, ongoing support from the California Healthcare Foundation and numerous dozens of other physician organizations, the California Hospital Association, many, many other organizations, has allowed us to widely implement PULSE in California.
Thank you, Dr. Middleberger, for joining us today and giving us all that valuable information about PULSE. Now we're going to turn to a short video that shows us how PULSE works in action.
There are many different ways to approach end of life.
As paramedics, we try to treat the patients exactly the way they wish to be treated.
It is not about age, it's about the chapter of your life.
The key thing in geriatrics especially, although it's true in cancer treatment, is not what can we do, but what should we do.
Over the last decade, attitudes and practices regarding end-of-life medical care have changed dramatically. That's partly due to a program begun in Oregon known as PULSED, Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. In Oregon, and now in several other states, seriously ill patients nearing the end of their lives may state simply and clearly what treatments they do or do not want.
A pulse form is actually real beneficial for us because it gives us information that the patient may not be able to give us in an emergency situation. So it kind of communicates the patient's desires when they're unable to, or if family members or caregivers are not available.
One of the important things to remember about the pulse form is that it allows people to choose whatever they want, including, I would want to be resuscitated, I would want everything possibly done. And so having a pulse form itself doesn't tell you what the person wants. It tells you that they've thought about what they would like, and you need to look at it closely.
Here's a detailed look at California's pulse form. It's a bright pink page with all the required information on one side of the sheet. That way, it is easy to spot and easy to read. The first section pertains to cardiopulmonary resuscitation. This is only used when the patient does not have a pulse and is not breathing. Some people choose the attempt resuscitation option. In reality, however, less than 1% of frail nursing home patients can be successfully resuscitated. So some choose to mark the box, Do Not Attempt Resuscitation. That's known as a DNR order, or Allow Natural Death. Patients who choose attempt resuscitation must choose full treatment in Section B.
It's hard to talk about do not resuscitate, especially with someone who's still going out and enjoying life with their family. One of the main goals of Pulsed is to initiate rich conversations between patients and their healthcare providers. In these conversations, people can explore their feelings, values, and goals, as well as get a better understanding of their medical conditions, treatment options, and prognosis. Family members, and especially healthcare decision makers, will gain greatly from the insights they get on their loved one's wishes. As a physician, one of the things I love most about Pulsed is that this is proactive healthcare centered around our patient's wishes. The Pulsed form then transforms these wishes into a set of medical orders which, by law in California, must be honored across the spectrum of healthcare, including emergency medical services, acute care hospitals, and skilled nursing facilities. It empowers our patients with the knowledge that they still have choices to make, and they can choose which medical treatments they want and avoid the interventions they don't want. When they reach this point in their journey, it becomes easier to choose between attempt resuscitation and do not resuscitate and allow a natural death.
Section B talks about medical interventions. The section is only in effect when a person has a pulse and/or is breathing. Some people wish to have every possible medical treatment. Others with a more serious illness might want to set limits. For example, they might not want to go into intensive care, but would wish to go to the hospital for less aggressive treatment. Many patients do not want to be intubated or be on a machine to breathe for them, but may consider non-invasive positive airway pressure devices. Some people wish only to be made comfortable, taking no measures to extend their lives. Sometimes patients must be moved because it is not possible to maintain their comfort where they are. Also, patients may have special feelings regarding blood transfusions, dialysis, and other measures which they may write in under additional orders.
Comfort measures are never optional. They must be given. Things like keeping the person warm or clean or giving them pain medication. So there is no way to write a set of orders on the Pulsed form that will allow those to be optional.
The final healthcare category is artificially administered nutrition. Food and fluids are always offered by mouth if feasible. Some patients would like a feeding tube or total IV nutrition. Recent studies have shown that for patients in an irreversible coma, feeding by tube or vein can lengthen their lives. However, for patients with advanced cancer or Alzheimer's disease, it may not, so they may not want tube feeding. Some patients may want tube feeding for a defined trial, especially when they have a reversible condition and may return to their previous status.
what happens to the nature of human contact. That's the most important thing that should happen in the last stages of life. And tube feedings or artificial nutrition change that nature. And we can do just as well. Some studies have shown that the survival rate is the same with well-done hand feeding. So if they're in the last stages of life, we can do just as well at getting them nutrition, and more importantly, much better at getting them human contact through hand feeding than we would through artificial nutrition.
Section D concludes with signatures of both the physician and the patient, or their healthcare decision maker. These signatures are required for the pulse form to be followed. There's also space for a summary of medical conditions, such as metastatic cancer or advanced heart failure. The backside of the page contains patient information as well as the name and contact information of the healthcare decision maker. If another healthcare professional actually fills out the form, they should note this on the back side, where there are directions for completing, using, reviewing, modifying, or voiding the pulsed form.
Here's an example of how a pulsed form might work. This patient has advanced cancer, which has spread to his bones, and is enrolled in a home hospice program. His hospice nurse is helping him, with his wife at his side, make the decisions that will determine his end-of-life treatment plan. She explains each section of the pulsed form, and after asking questions and conferring with his wife, he makes his decisions. The patient wants comfort measures only, no medical interventions aimed at prolonging his life. When they're finished, the nurse phones in the order to the patient's physician, who will later sign it. Then she signs the form. The pulse is placed on the refrigerator door, in plain sight if it's needed. A few months later, the patient's health begins to decline. His cancer spreads, and he falls in his living room. His wife calls 911, and the paramedics arrive. Seeing that the patient has a valid pulsed form, the EMTs concentrate on his comfort. It appears he may have broken his hip, so they transport him to emergency. The injury is not life-threatening, but the patient's pain needs to be brought under control at a healthcare facility. In emergency, the patient's injury is treated and his pain brought under control. When it's time to be discharged, a social worker explains that he'll need short-term care at a nursing facility. She talks with the patient about his pulsed form and makes sure his wishes are clear and being followed. The patient's pulsed form travels with him from home to hospital to care facility. At each step, nursing staff discuss the form with the patient to make sure his treatment plan's being followed. They make sure the form is in the patient's chart, and when it's time to go back home, the pulsed goes with him. Over the past few years, a number of research studies have been conducted on end-of-life medical treatment issues, and results indicate the PULSE program is working.
Several studies have been conducted on the PULSE program, and all show that the PULSE form is highly effective at ensuring treatment preferences are honored. In one of the first studies conducted in Oregon nursing facilities, none of the residents who were enrolled received unwanted CPR, ventilator support, or treatment in an intensive care unit during the course of the study.
The only way a pulse program can really work, though, is if patients, their families, and their health care providers talk to one another.
There was a very interesting study that showed that in this large group of 75-year-olds, they asked them, have you thought about what treatments you would want at the end of life? And 76% had. Then they asked them, how many of you have talked to your doctors about your wishes? Only 17%. Then they asked their doctors, have you thought about what treatments you'd give these older people? 67% had. Have you talked to the patient yet? Only 10%. The most common reason given for both groups as to why there was this difference between thinking and talking was because they were waiting for the other one to bring it up.
Since Oregon instituted its PULSE program, a number of states have developed their own versions.
Because PULSE forms are now being generated in a number of different communities and states, a number of leaders in each of those states, including Oregon, felt that it would be very helpful to have a collaborative effort. And because of that, we formed the National Advisory Panel for PULSED and PULSED-like programs so that we could really benefit from each other's experience with the form and its implementation.
You can really lift a burden from those you love by completing an advance directive and having the physician fill out and sign a PULSED form so that your loved one lives the way they wanted and dies where they wanted without treatments that they didn't want and receiving the ones they did.
To learn more about Pulsed in California or to start a coalition in your area, contact Coalition for Compassionate Care of California at www.capolst.org. For more information on the National Pulsed effort, contact Center for Ethics in Healthcare, Oregon Health and Science University at www.pulsed.org.
Now we have an opportunity to listen in on a Pulsed conversation. The heart of Pulsed is the conversation behind the form. And it's a physician's order, so that conversation between the patient and the physician is critical. While there's often other healthcare professionals, including nurses, social workers, and chaplains, who are involved in the conversation and help with completing the form, it is a physician's order. So today we have the opportunity to listen in on the office visit of Betsy with her physician, Dr. Jeff Yee. Dr. Yee is the Chief of Internal Medicine at Woodland Healthcare in Woodland, California. He's the lead physician for the Pulsed Pilot and Coalition in Yolo County. He testified before the legislature on AB 3000, which implemented Pulsed and established it in California law. And he's been instrumental in creating the curriculum in California for teaching healthcare professionals on how to have the Pulsed conversation.
Betsy, I'm looking through your chart, and I don't see that I have an advanced directive file on file for you. Do you have an advanced directive?
I do indeed, but I don't know why you don't have a copy. I'll bring you one.
Okay.
I got lots.
You know, I'm really glad that you have one and have taken time to go over that. But, you know, your situation is not uncommon. For many people who have an advanced directive, their physicians don't have a copy, and there's even many more out there who don't have an advanced directive at all. But in any case, you know, we have initiated a new program here in our office that I'm really excited about, and I think it really helps address some of these issues. And I think this is a really good time to go over that here.
Okay.
It's a program that is called Pulsed. Let me get one of these forms out and show it to you. And what stands for is Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And this goes over three scenarios that I want to go over them with you, okay?
Yep.
We're going to start with Section C down here. This says artificially administered nutrition. What that means is a feeding tube. Yeah, okay, but let me describe to you how that might be. Let's pretend that you've had a stroke. A stroke is a blood clot that causes brain damage. Now, if it damages the left side of your brain, that's the part of your brain that allows you to talk to me, talk to your family, and allows you to understand what people are saying to you. And right beside that part of the brain is the part of the brain that also controls your swallowing. So if you've had this kind of stroke, you know what? You might be in the hospital for 3 or 4 days, and the nurses might be trying to feed you, and you're not able to really communicate with them all that well. They may put food into your mouth, and you either choke on it, gag on it, or it might just sit there, or it might dribble out of your mouth. And then after a few days, the neurologist may come in and say, well, at her age, and with her emphysema and diabetes, this is probably permanent, but if her heart's working okay, Dr. G, let's put in a feeding tube and we could keep her alive that way. What do you think about that?
You better explain why that's going to be better for me. If I can't talk to anybody?
Well, I don't know that it's better for you. Now, some people think that that's going to give them a better chance at living more time. I don't know about that. Other people would say, but that's living a pretty impaired life. If that's permanent and I can't communicate and I can't eat, then, and those people are going to say, you know what, I don't want that if that kind of situation happens.
Feeding tube, you don't eat, it goes into you. You don't get to taste it or smell it or anything.
And that's right. That's absolutely right. I think you're telling me that in that kind of situation, you would not want a feeding tube.
I definitely would not want a feeding tube.
I'm going to go ahead and mark this box here that says no artificial nutrition. The next situation I want to ask you about is called cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, but what about it?
Okay. Here's the kind of situation that this might happen in. You might be at home. And let's say you start not feeling well, that your chest starts to hurt, you're uncomfortable, and you really look kind of sick. Your husband sees that, and he's worried about you having a heart attack. He might have seen that, you know, in someone before. So he calls for an ambulance. And just as the ambulance is pulling up to your door, you know, you collapse on the ground. And the paramedics, they come rushing in, and there you are on the ground. You're unconscious. You're not talking to them, you're not talking to your husband, you're not moving. They take out their equipment in a hurry, and they hook you up, and they find out you're not breathing, and their equipment shows that your heart is completely stopped.
You mean I'm dead?
That's really what's happening. Your body is really in the dying stages. It is dead. But there are a few moments in which CPR can be tried. Now, CPR is where they have to try to shock the heart with large amounts of electricity, and they have to squeeze on the chest to try to stimulate circulation. Mostly, that doesn't work in someone your age. It's really a last attempt, and there's a very, very few people in which we can revive the heart. But for most of those people, even if the heart is revived, you know, there's moments in which there's no oxygen. So even in that small number of people in which the heart is revived, many of them suffer brain damage, and many of them still die in the hospital. But, you know, we do want to ask about that, because some people will say, but, you know, if that's my only chance, then I want you to try.
So if I were one of those people who said, oh, it's a one in a million, I still want it, then I'd say yes?
Then we would respect that absolutely, and that's why we have these conversations.
But if I've heard you right, you say I'm an old lady, and if my heart stopped, it probably should stay stopped.
Well, I didn't say the old lady part.
You know how old I am. It says right there.
You know, I would agree with you, because I really don't think that this works well in your situation and the problems I've seen that come in the aftermath of it are huge and tremendous. So,
the problems like I don't get very well and I'm in the hospital for a long time and the family has to come visit me when I'm in tubes all over the place?
And most of the time you'll die
anyway.
No,
thank you.
Okay. So you're pretty clear on that. I'm going to mark here this box here that says do not attempt resuscitation, allow a natural death.
Don't even try it.
I hear you. Okay. So here's the third situation that I want to ask you about. Let's pretend you're at home, you get a flu bug, and you're in bed, and you're thinking, no, I'm going to get better. But after a few days, instead of getting better, you've gotten a lot worse. Where all of a sudden your temperature has gone up to 103, you're having a lot harder time breathing, you're coughing, nothing's coming up, and you're feeling all congested. Your husband brings you to the emergency room. They find your oxygen level is really low. They put extra oxygen on you, and that doesn't help. They get an x-ray, and they see a bad, bad pneumonia. And they're going to want to put you in the hospital and start antibiotics. But you know, antibiotics can take a few days to get someone better. And given your condition, Betsy, you know, they might be thinking, we might be thinking, that you're not strong enough to get through those 3 or 4 days for the antibiotics to work. In that case, what the hospital is going to want to do is to put you into the intensive care unit. And there, they would want to put you on a ventilator. That's a life support machine. It is a machine where a tube goes down into your throat, and that machine then forces extra air and oxygen into your lungs. It is terribly uncomfortable, and in order to try to keep people comfortable, we're going to give them morphine, Valium, you know. But the hope is, in a few days, that there will be well enough, the antibiotics would have worked, and we can get them off of that breathing machine, off of that life support machine. What do you think about that kind of situation?
My mother-in-law had something sort of like that, and she actually had an advance directive. This is a long time ago. And she said she didn't want antibiotics. So her death was pretty quiet. You know, they gave her the right medications and it was pretty peaceful. But you're saying my body, that I might get better, and people would say maybe that I should give it a chance.
I would estimate that your odds of getting better and getting off that machine, if this were to happen next week, are probably 60%, maybe
70%. 60%, 70? That's quite a lot. Why wouldn't I do that?
Some people choose not to do that because they say, I've had a comfortable life. That sounds like it's pretty hard. And I'm not sure how, even if I get better, if I get off those machines, I'm not sure how I'm going to be. It is true, if this happens to you, you will be quite weak afterwards. You might be so weak that you need to go to a convalescent home. I wouldn't expect there to be any brain damage or neurologic damage, but you will be very weak afterwards. And so some people choose against that because they're not ready to have that type of recovery, or they're not ready to be sick for that long, even after they get off the breathing machine.
So you said I start with, I've had a comfortable life, and it's going to go seriously downhill after that.
It can take a while for you to get better.
Well, supposing they just did it for a little while.
I think people are afraid of saying yes and then being stuck on these machines forever. And I fill out this form in this way. I mark on here full treatment, and that means that we start. And then I also write in here, trial period only. Not to be kept on life support if not expected to recover. So if instead of getting better, we find that your body's slipping, getting worse, where the kidneys need help, where the blood pressure needs extra help, then what this tells us is not to keep you on those machines just to see how much longer we can keep your body going if we know that you're going to, that your body's in the process of giving out.
So I suppose a reasonable person would say, okay, let's do a trial. And I guess I'm a reasonable person, so okay.
You have to know too, Betsy, that someday, if you know if your condition changes, that you're worse, and you know that you can't get through that, then we can go back and we could change this form.
Oh, good. So I would say give it a trial now, and then I go along and I go along, and I can't hike much, and I can't do much more, and I can't do less. I'm doing less and less. I'm not as comfortable as I was in my life.
Then we may need to revisit this form.
And you'll help me do that.
Absolutely. So, with this form, what I've marked here, though, in Section A, I've marked, you know, if your heart stops, to allow a natural death.
Yep.
I've marked here in Section B, full treatment, but for a trial period only.
Yep.
not to be kept on life support.
And we both understand what that trial means.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Down here I'll mark no artificial nutrition by tube.
Okay.
In case that you can't communicate with us and you can't swallow.
Okay.
So, with my signature and your signature both, then this becomes a valid form.
Okay.
All right. So, Betsy, I'm going to go ahead and sign this here. I'm going to ask you to sign this.
Now, you better put the date because I always forget what the date is.
Absolutely. With both of our signatures, this becomes a completely valid form. It is, in fact, a physician's order.
Where's me?
Oh, right there. Down there.
Okay.
Okay. Now, my office staff is going to make copies of this.
Wait a minute. I have to print it.
All right. And so we're going to keep copies, but you are going to take this form home, and you're going to place this in a place where it's usable so that if paramedics get called, they're going to see this because they're going to respect this now because it's a physician's order. The other thing I want you to do is to show this to your family members and tell them what we've talked about. Then they'll know, you know, that you have thought about this.
So supposing on my way home, you give me that one. I go home and I go to the copy center and I make a whole bunch of copies for all the family and I talk about it.
That
and
would
I
be
give it to all the people who should have it.
That would be a really good idea.
Okay.
Okay. What you've just seen is a typical Pulse conversation. The dialogue is created by presenting three common clinical scenarios to the patient. Section A talks about having a cardiac arrest in the face of a large MI. Section B is about having a pneumonia and facing the possibility of ventilator care. And Section C is about having a stroke or other forms of brain damage in which a patient is non-communicative and may need a feeding tube. In this type of setting, in these scenarios, patients relate to these presentations well. Pulse conversations don't happen spontaneously. They do have to be nurtured. But once you become sensitized to the need, the opportunities really do abound. We talk about pulse in the office, especially if a family member comes in with the patient. Pulse conversations happen when we admit the patient to the hospital. And another opportune time is when the patient is being discharged to a skilled nursing facility. Most of my pulse conversations are completed in an office visit. For one of my other partners, though, they feel more comfortable introducing the subject than scheduling a return time for the patient to come back. Another one of my partners may initiate the subject, then direct the patient towards our nurse practitioner to complete the form and answer any questions. In other healthcare settings, we do find that other trained individuals can be very helpful in counseling on the form and completing the form. The reality is, for pulse conversations, for those patients who pulse can apply to, many of these patients know what they want. So there's many ways in which a pulse form can be completed. In any way that it's done, if it's done correctly, though, I know that pulse will have a huge impact upon your practice and especially upon your patients.
So Dr. Middleberger, can you summarize for us what we learned today?
Yes, we've learned that in California, we have an opportunity, a significant opportunity, to improve the care that we give to patients as they approach the end of life. We've learned that there is a better technique and a better implement in which we can make sure that patients get the things that they do want, the treatments they do want, and don't get treatments that they don't want. And that procedure, that is called the PULSED. And by filling out a PULSED form, we allow patients or ourselves to make sure that we get just those treatments that we would want to receive.
Great. What should people do next? What next steps should they take?
The first thing people should do is make sure they've taken care of their own pulse form. Talk to your own physician, get your own advance directive, and if appropriate, get your own pulse form done. And if you're a healthcare provider, learn about the pulse, participate in some of the training. Make sure that we make pulse a part of the way that care is provided in your healthcare system or clinic to patients. And third, as a member of California Communities, let's make sure that we spread the word about pulse, so that everybody in California has the right at the near or the end of life to get the treatments that they do want and not receive the treatments that they don't want.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Middleberger. Appreciate your being here today. And I'd also like to thank Dr. Yi, Betsy Carpenter, our model patient, and Aaron Henke, who's worked tirelessly behind the scenes to make this possible. I'd also once again like to thank UC Davis Center for Healthy Aging and the UC Academic Geriatric Resource Program for their support of this program, as well as the California Healthcare Foundation that has provided financial support to make Pulsed possible in California. To find out more, visit the Pulsed website at www.capulsed.org. Again, that's www.californiapulsed.org. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.